Okay, Jorge, CEO and co-founder of Reku. My man, thank you so much for joining us, brother.
No, thank you, Quinton, for having me. I love you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes,
Thank
well,
you.
I'm equally as excited for you to be here as well, my man. So, I was doing some research on your company, Reku, and I came across a staggering statistic that I wanted to jump into real quick. It is 57% of corporate overdue accounts don't get collected each year in Latin America. In other words, companies lend money directly or allow others to buy their goods and services on credit. More than half of those unpaid bills never get recovered, and that equated to $5.8 billion in 2024. Did I get that right?
You get it very, very right. You did your homework, and it is actually like that.
Yeah.
And that's the problem we tackle with Reku.
So here's my first question for you, Jorge. I read that statistic and I was blown away because if I give my brother $20, I'm not letting him go without paying me back the next day. So how is this even possible? How is this even a problem? I really truly am flabbergasted by that.
Yeah, I imagine that for you from a US perspective, that sounds crazy. I don't know in the US how it works, but I can imagine it is nothing like that. But in Colombia and in Latin America, it's a huge problem, mostly related to the inefficiencies in our judicial system. Normally, you should have a procedure that is fast, that is effective, in terms of allowing you to get paid with what you owed. Like, debt collection judicial procedures should work, but the truth is they don't work because our judicial systems are kind of fragile and so slow and so full with process and with a lot of things to do. Judges don't have many time to deal with all the workload they have. The consequence is that a lot of people doesn't go through justice to actually claim what they are owed. And in terms of, I don't know, contractual obligations, it is hard to actually demand what you owed if you don't have like the law or the legal system backing you up and offering you the tools to actually get paid. So what we're trying to do is to solve that problem with technology. We figure out that rather than a legal issue or a justice problem, from a juridic perspective, it is mostly a technological problem. And what we are trying to build is a software or a technology that helps our judicial systems to become more effective and to actually tackle this lack of responses in terms of debt collection here in Latin America.
Okay, so that's really, really interesting, and it's I guess not surprising that it's kind of local to Latin America and just how like the legal system works. Obviously, I'm not very familiar with it. Do you think that that's something that's do you think like companies and individuals take advantage of these companies deliberately? Do you think it's malicious, or do you think it's more like they just kind of fault on their credit because they can't pay it back for whatever reason? Like, do you think there's like malice intent? How does that kind of play out in your head?
I think it is a combination of several factors. I wouldn't say that the main reason why companies don't get paid is because they have malicious clients or debtors. I think the economy here in Latin America has a huge impact in payment capabilities of companies. It is not e for. We have a lot of informality. I don't know if I can say that for Latin America in general, but for sure in Peru, Ecuador, even Mexico, this is kind of a struggle. There is a lot of informality. Here in Colombia, 60% of companies are not formal, meaning that they are operating, they are generating income, but a little bit outside the law, not complying with all the regulations they should be complying. And this makes our corporate sector very fragile as well. So these are companies that are struggling to live on a daily basis. So if anything goes wrong, their payment capabilities almost disappear. They want to pay, but they don't have the capacity of paying. And if you take that, you take the all the problems that our judicial systems have, there you have like the magic equation for this number that you were talking about in the first place. So companies don't get paid.
Yeah. And okay. That's okay. I love this. So I was listening to you speak at one of your, at a conference or something like that. And you mentioned that one of the problems is it's very costly to collect on some of the debt that people owe. Is that just through the legal system? Is it just difficult to take people to court and try to get the money back? And so they just kind of call it a wash as an organization, or like what makes it so costly?
Yeah. I mean, as our judicial system is not very effective, a legal procedure takes a lot of time, and time is equal to cost. So if you need to pass through a judicial procedure over 3 or 5 years, there are a lot of costs implied, which makes it difficult for a company who's owed, I don't know, a huge amount to go through it. I mean, if you are owed $1,000, you are not going to go through a process over 3 years to get paid just $1,000. And there is, I think it is kind of normal, but also for a lawyer, it's quite complicated to actually represent a company over 3 years just to get paid some amount related to a debt of $1,000. And we don't have a lot of alternatives different from going to a judicial procedure to actually get paid, where legal system has not created like alternative methods, more efficient, faster, to actually allow these kind of transactions. So lawyers are expensive, which is kind of normal. Judicial procedures take a lot of time, and this informal sector doesn't have like all the resources, doesn't have the technology to cope with their necessities in terms of getting paid and protecting their cash flow. So it's like a combination of a lot of factors
that
gives us this context, difficult context.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds very convoluted. There's a lot of like a lot of things at play here. So from what I understand, your software does a handful of things. First of all, it sends out reminders to companies like, hey, you know, you have an unpaid debt that you need to pay back the company. It's sending out these polite things over a period of time. But it also has AI algorithms built into it that allow for the company to determine how likely it is that the debt's going to be able to be actually reconciled, right? Like, how does that work? Are you pulling like credit scores from these other companies, from these people? Like, how are you able to determine whether or not this individual is likely to pay their credit? And if I'm off, by all means, please let me know.
No, it's I think it's pretty much what we do. Basically, what we have built with our software is an automation technology that takes care of all the life cycle of debt collection from an early stage perspective, which would be mostly preventive, from mostly persuasive collection to actually reaching out to the debtors and communicating with them and convincing them to pay. And also this judicial stage, and that's what I think makes us unique, because we are the only ones who are actually tackling this final stage of the debt collection related to the judges. Actually, we began with this stage, mostly focused on automating debt collection of judicial procedures. And from there, we went backwards until this preventive stage. And what we are doing is automating through AI agents, these interactions with customers or with debtors to send just reminders or to actually negotiate payment agreements. We are also doing this payment conciliation, receiving and getting information from bank accounts or payment methods, and doing the conciliation with the statements, financial statements, to actually know if a debtor is owing a given amount or if he already paid what he was owing. And from there, we can evolve in the collection perspective to actually reaching out this debtor and getting to negotiate, convince them. Actually, we are replacing a lot of tasks that are very manual, that don't add value. And for companies, mostly small or medium-sized companies, it's kind of expensive and hard because they should hire someone to actually do it. It takes time if you have a lot of debt. So you need, I don't know, 2-3 people on the phone calling the debtors and doing the conciliation. And once you're not able to reach to an agreement, then you need a lawyer. So you gotta go and find a lawyer who actually begins the judicial procedure. So the whole thing can be very expensive, very... I don't know. It's kind of a problem, and it is not the core of the business from a small company. So we are taking care of that.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes total sense. Are you guys typically working with like small to medium businesses, I'm assuming then?
We began with the small and medium sized business. We began in 2023, actually. We began developing the technology in 2021. Then we had like 2 years of validation and iteration to actually discover what was the business case, the most interesting business case, and how we could have an impact on Colombian society and Colombian economy. In 2023, we began to work with small and medium-sized business. We are still doing it. But in 2024, I think it was kind of organic. Had this evolution through or mostly to microcredit fintechs. We are helping fintechs with them managing their debt collections. And this year we began with to work with some financial institutions, mostly banks here in Colombia. But we are still tackling this issue for small and medium sized companies, and is what passionates me the most. Actually, working with these small companies,
I love that. Okay, so that kind of leads me into my next set of questions here. I kind of wanted to lay like the groundwork and the foundation for what Reku does, but now I want to kind of pick your brain about like the inception of it. Right, when I met you back in Paris, your background was mostly in the legal field, right? You were a lawyer, and I believe you were practicing before we had met. And then all of a sudden, now you're a co-founder of a software company, which is just amazing. See, what you do kind of ties into the legal sector. How did you even come across this problem? Like, obviously, it is a problem. It's one that I'm not familiar with myself. How did you recognize it? And then how did you then say, okay, me and my co-founder, we're going to start a company around this? Kind of, could you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it was a problem that we had when me and my co-founder as a lawyers, I was mostly working in the financial sector and with litigation. And, any Colombian lawyer would agree with me that working with the judicial system here in Colombia is very difficult, is very stressful. It doesn't work. You always have this feeling that it does not operate. And it is not because the judges don't want to do their jobs. It's because they lack the tools, the technology, their processes, don't work. And actually, it was kind of in Paris during the MBA that I began to build this idea to actually see that most of the problems of our judicial system were not legal. And it is a big thing that all the judicial administration is filled with lawyers who have no idea about logistics or technology. So we are always solving these problems from a legal perspective. And it doesn't work, you know, for solving a technological problem. The first thing, approach is to create a new law, for example.
Right.
It doesn't solve anything. So,
right.
So what we did with my co-founder, he happens to be very enthusiastic about technology. I have always said that he studied law as an accident because he's an engineer from his soul. We began to work in an MVP or beta version, probably, of an automated workflow for dealing with a judicial procedure. That's what we did in 2021, just for solving lawyers' lives, lawyers in the litigation sector. And from then, we loved the idea. We loved what we were achieving with our own cases. When I came back to Colombia, I began to litigate all that I knew at the moment. But we, with my co-founder, we said we want to litigate, but with technology. Let's see what technology can do and automation can do for us. And the results were quite interesting. So the idea began like that. 2 years later, after reaching out customers and getting to know the market, we discovered that the legal field is just a solution for actually real problems. And the real problems behind some of the legal procedures we had were not the legal procedure itself, but, for example, get paid. So the customer doesn't give too much attention to, I don't know if we can curse in this
podcast. Yeah, of course.
Okay, thank you. So a client or a customer doesn't give a fuck about the legal procedure. He wants to get paid.
Totally.
And getting paid, it goes beyond the law. So we began to tackle other problems related to actually getting paid. And we began to develop the technology to help companies in other stages of debt collection. And then we tackled this persuasive stage and then the early stage. And from then, it was too much for two lawyers creating software. So we looked for a good CTO that could help us developing the technology. And we began to create a team actually with technological capabilities that we didn't have as founders. And that's how Recu became what it is today.
I love that. Okay. So I had a mentor once tell me that businesses make decisions based on three things, right? Increasing revenue, decreasing costs, and mitigating risk. It sounds like you guys almost tackle all three of those for small to medium-sized businesses. It also sounds like you're benefiting the legal system. Do you guys work with lawyers and judges as well? Have you gotten feedback from them? Like, what is that process like? Because that's like, it almost seems like you're coming at two different prongs here, right? From a business perspective, but you're also having to work with the legal side of things as well.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I had a beautiful coincidence when I came back from France in 2020, just before the pandemic began and became serious here in Colombia as well. I met a bunch of lawyers quite interested in how can we use technology to help the legal system. A bunch of guys just like me, with the same questions and interests. And in 2020, we began the Legal Tech Colombian Association, with other startups in the legal tech field and professionals, mostly lawyers. And from there, we created an ecosystem of professionals related to technological and business ecosystems with lawyers. And we began to actually open up these conversations about how can we create bridges to give lawyers a different perspective. This ecosystem helped me and helped Recu to actually operate and to get in touch with judges, with the judicial system, with policymakers. It was quite important. And we also had another coincidence. Pandemic was actually, I think from my perspective, maybe some lawyers would not agree, but that's how I see it. Pandemic was here in Colombia actually was a good thing for the judicial system because it forced us to go digital because as judges could not receive the people in their offices, we had to begin to use, virtual meetings to actually receive documents through an email, which before it was not possible. But the pandemic kind of obliged this to happen. And after that, it became a legal modification here in Colombia to actually allow virtual justice to exist. So we wouldn't be doing what we're doing if that policy wouldn't have changed here in Colombia. And those two factors helped us a lot to interact with the legal field.
I mean, it sounds like a perfect storm for Recu to be to blossom.
And for a lot of legal techs here in Colombia, there was like a boom after that, after 2020.
That's fascinating. And are you guys just in Colombia or you guys operate all across Latin America?
For now, we're just in Colombia, but we are exploring an expansion maybe to Peru or Mexico. We are actually evaluating the possibility of beginning probably next semester. I would say probably with Peru. Okay. And right now we are also collecting debt for a Colombian company in the US, but with Hispanic customers in the US.
Sure. So, dude, that's so exciting, man. I love that. And I would imagine like what, because Colombia is... It's much more developed than other parts of South America. So if you guys are running into these problems, I can imagine that that's happening all over the place. You know what I mean? So it's a problem that I think that a lot of people can relate to. I'm curious what it looks like in the United States and how severe that problem is. I'm sure that it happens on a certain level. I mean, just what you were saying earlier, right? If you have somebody that owes you $1,000, you're not going to take them to court over the next X amount of years to collect $1,000. So there's got to be some sort of net loss across the board, you know, from a global perspective. Very, very interesting.
That's not a problem that exclusively of Latin America or just Colombia. And I wouldn't say we are an unique solution that we came up and it doesn't exist something similar to us. There are some examples of companies doing some things quite similar in Argentina, in Chile, and in the US as well. So
I'm going to give you credit for the first and only company that solved this problem. We're gonna
we do it better that. Though.
There you go.
We are better. Yeah,
you got the competitive advantage. I love it. That's awesome, man. I did a lot of research on Recu, and I see you're out there, you're marketing, you're doing a lot of things to kind of promote the company. It sounds like a lot of what you're doing right now is obviously promotion, but building connections and trying to get bridge gaps between the legal system and then the tech system and then the banking system. There's a lot of different things in there. Do you feel like the majority of what you're doing is like promoting the benefits of Recu, or do you feel like a lot of what you're doing is like just building connections and building those relationships?
I think the most important would be probably to building meaningful connections in all levels, allies, employees, stakeholders, customers. I think it would be a good definition of my role in the company, but I'll also keeping the company alive, you know, and solving anything that needs to be solved. I think I have a phrase for that in the Spanish, but I don't know how to translate it. But I am actually coping with whatever the company needs. But yeah, actually building meaningful connections.
Well, I love it, man. Because the way that I look at it, obviously, is as a company, you're gonna have to generate revenue. There's no question. Like, without revenue, your company is just gonna wither away and die, right? But having said that, building those long-term connections, that, I mean, that's what's going to keep you guys afloat for a longer period of time. And it's also going to help you kind of expand. And like, I come from sales. And if you know anything about sales, a lot of how I made deals happen wasn't necessarily presenting the value of the product itself. I know some people are going to scream and yell at this podcast for me saying that, but a lot of it is, who do you know and how can you get your foot into the door? And then from there, now you can start to talk about the value of your company. So I'm a huge believer in building relationships. I think that that goes a long, long way. So I hear you. You're wearing a lot of different hats. You obviously have to sell the product to keep you guys afloat. But at this stage, it sounds like building those connections and building those bridges across those different sectors has got to be at the forefront of a lot of what your effort is.
Yeah, for sure. And as I said, in a level, you gotta do that with your employees, with your co-founders, with investors, with customers. And it is also about building a culture for your organization and people actually believing and being ambassadors of what you're doing. So yeah, no, it's pretty much it. You cannot build anything by yourself, so you need to have good people around you having the same vision and totally with the same compromise as you. And the more people you get to join you in that trip, the more successful the company will be. Okay. It's all about connecting with people, for sure.
Totally. Okay, that's a great segue into my next set of questions here. So I've been a part of, when I left the MBA program, I joined two different companies. One was like a pretty small startup. I think there was less than 300 people. And then we had another company that I was a part of that was just under 1,000, but it was much larger. The cultures were vastly different. Now, part of that I can say was because of the pandemic, right? Like when I joined the first company, the pandemic hadn't happened yet. So I was going into the office 5 days a week. You obviously get to know your colleagues much more intimately. And then once I joined this other company, the pandemic had already happened. We were mostly digital. So that obviously might have had a huge impact on the culture in of itself. But it was a lot more fun to work for a small company. And I think part of it was because everyone was galvanized behind one single mission. And I don't even want to go into how much I didn't care about the mission itself, but I loved the people that I worked with and that motivated me every day. You have a really unique company. How do you build a culture as a CEO? Like, how do you get people galvanized behind a software platform that is tied to fintech, to legal, and to the banking industry, which, you know, please don't be mad at me for saying this, isn't the most exciting, you know, we're changing the world type of thing, but obviously you have to build some sort of culture around that. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, actually, I think we are solving a huge, interesting problem, a passionate problem. So I would say that's the first thing, that if we are passionate about solving the problem and we see the importance of what we're doing, then it is easier to communicate, I don't know, a vision, a set of tasks and everything from there. And as I see it, and I would say as my co-founders and our collaborators see it, we are actually helping Colombian economy and we are helping companies here in our economic system to be more resilient, to create jobs, to survive, you know? That's a huge thing. But it is also about surrounding yourself of people who's motivated, who's curious, who's empathetic. Because there are some very, very talented people that you can find in the in your path. But if they don't have this same, this set of skills, soft skills, it is difficult to create a good culture for your organization. So I would say it's a combination of being passionate about the problem and keeping focus on whatever is needed, we're going to find a solution for this problem. You should be in love of the problem more than the solution, because the solution, we have changed the solution. I don't know how many times we have, probably we're changing it each 2 weeks, but but the problem we're tackling is the same, and it's a huge problem for, I don't know, for people who are impacting people's lives, but also there is a very interesting market behind it. And as a team, we have fun, we trust each other, we are empathetic, we are curious, we are, I don't know, I would not say we are a family, because I don't like that. I don't know, you don't have a family in your work. Your totally. Family is your family. But we are a team, and we're together, and we're looking up for the same objectives. Yeah, and we are good people. We are nice people, and that's important, you know.
Totally. Okay, nice. So you sold me. I am now 100% bought in, and I love it, man. But you guys really do
come
have
come, yeah.
Come
join
us. Come work for you in Colombia.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, but I have to learn Spanish first. Unless some of your clients will speak English.
That's easy.
Yeah. No, I think, dude, okay, so first of all, that was a perfect answer, right? I mean, you guys obviously have a mission statement that you guys are operating around. And if you're really tied to the idea of wanting to help people, that is no greater sense of purpose. You know what I mean? And that's exactly what this whole podcast is about, is helping people. So I can 100% relate there. I also want to call out, before we started the conversation, you and I were chatting, and we were kind of laughing about the fact that you're the janitor, you're the CEO, you're this, you're that, you're doing everything all at once. I would say a big part of building culture is leading by example. So I just have to tip my hat to you in that regard. Another thing that you touched on that I was curious about is curiosity. So how do you stay curious? How do you keep your employees curious? That's a really important thing if you want to grow as a small company, is kind of asking the questions that maybe you're not thinking about now, but are going to be important for the future.
Yeah. Well, actually in Reku, we have to be curious, because we are putting together lawyers with software developers and engineers, and they usually speak two different languages, you know, language of law and the language of very technical issues. Engineers have to be curious enough to actually comprehend what the lawyers need, and the lawyers need to be curious enough to comprehend what the engineers are doing and why are we doing it that way. And I think this perspective of leading from example is quite important, because all the C-level, all the founders, we are actually learning all the time. For me, it has been a huge challenge to be at the front. I am not the CEO. I am not the CTO or the CPO, but I need to understand what the development team is doing. So I need to ask a lot of questions, actually learning. And that's amazing, because each time I am telling the software developers, please explain this to me as I was an idiot, because I am probably an idiot. So try to be as direct and make it simple. And the same for the lawyers. You gotta be able to explain that to anyone. So we are learning all the time, and we need to stay curious about what's happening in the company. And we work not as the legal team or the marketing team or the sales team or the IT team. We're just a team, and we need to be like interlocutors of everyone else. We're doing that all the time.
Yeah.
Asking questions.
Okay. This kind of brings up another thought. So you're obviously tackling a lot of different issues. It would be really easy for your company to be siloed in terms of the engineers and then the legal team and then everybody else. How many employees do you have?
Right now we're 14.
Okay, 14. I'm imagining that you're going to grow substantially over the next couple of years if all goes well. How do you prevent those silos from occurring? Because that's one of the biggest challenges that I recognized when I was with a small company. It was easy for everybody to be on the same page because we'd meet on, say, Fridays, and we'd all have, you know, lunch together, and we could talk about problems and da 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 da. And then when I moved to the larger company, that all kind of went away. And then you kind of are, you know, you're coming up with like ideas of what this other department is interested in or how they're solving problems. And there was very little communication. And the only communication that you had was me as the employee to my manager to that manager to those employees. And it obviously became very convoluted over time. Have you guys thought about that? Because this just sounds like a perfect use case to kind of understand how to prevent those silos from happening.
Yeah, actually, it is difficult. And I imagine that when you have like, I don't know, 1,000 employees, making that happen, it's quite hard. Mm-hmm. But right now we're facing the challenge. I am also part of another company, which is a consultancy firm, mostly a law firm called Legal Nova. So I'm a part of an ecosystem. Right now, my focus is on Reco, which is like my baby. But I am also a part of Legal Nova, which is a law firm. What we're trying to do is to create synergies between the two companies. In Legal Nova, we are right now 53 employees. So we have like this company mostly focused on delivering legal services for startups and investors and the entrepreneurship ecosystem here in Colombia and Latam. And we have Reco. We are sharing actually right now in the office of the two companies. And the challenge we have and I have is to, despite the size of, I don't know, 70 people gathering Reco and Legal Nova and having accountants, lawyers, and everything, how do we create the space, the room for all the collaborators to actually collaborate and create together? And what we have done is actually opening the spaces to, for example, one engineer teaching the lawyers about some basic concepts of AI, for example. Right. And lawyers giving teaching, one lawyer that can be the junior that arrived to the company, I don't know, 1 month ago, teaching everyone else about what he knows. And that's something we do every Friday, for example.
Right.
That's the reason why I needed to, before we connected to our interview. Actually, we're receiving an engineer that's going to do a little bit of a conference, yeah, for all his teammates. We have this Friday of beers in which the whole company is invited to have a beer and just talk with each other.
Sure.
I think it is possible that if you have the intention of that actually happening and you are creating spaces for that, when you are 100% remote, it's a little bit more difficult.
Totally.
But we have this hybrid system in which some days, some weekdays they are at home, and some weekdays they are here at the offices, and finding the way that knowledge from different teams goes through the whole organization. And I think it works well. For us, it has worked well. We have lawyers now that are actually developing software and creating MVPs with no code tools that then we pass through to the development team in order to create a native technology, but the lawyers themselves are creating the MVPs with no code or low code tools.
That is a really, really interesting concept. So they're the ones that basically come up with the ideas for a solution, and then you pass it over to your development team, and then they build it out natively in Preku.
Because the lawyers, as the owners of the business and the day-to-day job, they are the ones who have the best vision of what could work or what would be the ideal world of an operation. So if they have a set of skills that right now with AI and with a lot of tools that exist are capable of creating a beta version or an MVP, then it is easier for us to translate to the engineers what we actually need, because they are seeing an MVP that actually works. And that for us has been, I mean, amazing, because it helped us also to reduce times of development, product development, that there are MVPs that are already validated by an user who actually needs it to comprehend the pains
right
of the day-to-day job. So
that's absolutely fascinating. I'm just kind of mulling that over a little bit, because I really like that workflow. I think that's ingenious, to be totally transparent. This is just kind of coming a random thought. Does the legal team ever come up with a solution that your development team is like, no, we can't, like, there's no way that we're going to be able to pull that off?
Yeah, for sure. It happens all the time. And we can get very, very creative. And there are a lot of restrictions, because you can build something with no code that it looks so easy. And then if you identify the need of actually building it in a native technology, it is not that easy. There is like the IT team that has to raise their hand and say, okay, we can do it, but it's not that easy as that, you know, it's going to take some time.
Yeah, totally. I want to take this really techie and get geeky, but we're not going to go there for today's conversation. when you're hiring for your company, I'm looking at this from two different perspectives. The individuals need to be obviously competent in the legal system of Colombia, which obviously is rigid at times, but also fluid at times. But it also sounds like you're hiring individuals who have a certain level of creativity, because you have to be creative. You have to kind of come up with, you know, again, solutions to problems that maybe are unforeseen or that might, you know, come to fruition in the future. How are you hiring people? What does that hiring process look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, for the lawyer, we have a set of stages that they have to go through, technical tests, in which we evaluate legal knowledge, but also kind of soft skills, commercial approach. So usually what we ask them to do is to deliver a legal opinion on a matter, but also creating a proposal, commercial proposal for a customer, in which they have to present their legal opinion and try to pitch it to us. So in that matter, we evaluate their soft skills capacities, and not only, you know, the legal knowledge. But what has been more challenging than particularly for me is to hire good tech profiles and engineers. Because for me, evaluating a lawyer is easier because I know the field. I know what a good lawyer, I can differentiate a good lawyer from a not such a good one. But and for an engineer, it's quite difficult because I don't know much about it. I mean, if it gets very technical, I don't have a clue. Right now, we have, I don't know, an IT team that can deal with the technical issues of selecting a good developer. But what we do at the moment, and we have kept that logic, is that we first do, the first interview they have is with me and with the CEO, which is not technical at all. And we evaluate mostly the soft skills of the engineer, which is kind of weird because usually the last interview is, I don't know, with maybe with the CEO or with the C-level. We do it backwards. And it has been very helpful because what we try to validate is creativity, is this, I don't know, these commercial skills. So, for example, usual question we ask them is, we are going to deploy a new functionality of our software and we need to find, I don't know, 100 beta testers from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. What would you do in order to find us these 100 new beta testers? And it has nothing to do with technical knowledge. We are evaluating creativity, I don't know, how resourceful this person is. And once we have validated that, they go to the next stage, which is mostly technical. And for a startup, I think it's very, very important to have people who is very flexible, agile, resourceful, and yeah, creative, because the logic is that you're changing all the time. It's a little bit chaotic. For engineers, it's quite difficult, quite hard that you're changing all the time the sprints, for example, and the objectives of development. They don't like that, but the business needs it. So you need people who can cope with that, and it's not easy to find that. So that's the first thing we evaluate, for example.
Yeah, I have always thought that like one of the most important qualities in an employee is being resourceful. Right, is somebody that can figure out how to solve a problem on their own. I can imagine you can relate to that. You know, as a small company, you get a lot of fluidity. There's a lot of things that happen all at once. And if you're sitting there having to answer everybody's questions, you can't focus on what's important for your day to day. Right. So being resourceful has got to be super, super important. Okay. That's awesome, man. So let me ask you this. I want to take it a little bit more personal, if you don't mind. But do you have a hard stop at the top of the hour?
No.
Okay, great. Because I haven't gotten to the fun questions yet.
Go on for hours if you want.
Okay, perfect. my other question is, if I get hired, I only have to interview with you, right? I don't have to go through that whole rigmarole.
You need to go to the whole process.
All right, well,
no shortcut for you.
I love it. That's awesome. That's a great answer. So you're the CEO of this company. Incredible. Congratulations, man. I'm not at all surprised. Has there been anything that has surprised you in terms of your expectations? Like, you expected it to be like X, but really it's like Y. Do you think that it's harder than you thought, easier than you thought? Is there anything that like kind of stands out in your mind?
It's hard. It's very, very hard, I would say. But it's so rewarding, I think. It pays off in terms of feeling that you're building something that has impact, that actually matters. I think you can do it from having a job and being an employee. But it, at least for me, it was difficult to find a place where I felt that I was actually doing something that mattered, that was relevant and had an impact. The good thing about creating your business is that it is a canvas that you can fill with anything you have in your mind and actually motivates you, which is incredible. But it is 300 times more difficult than being a part of something that it is already created, that it is already operating, and that it works. You gotta make it work, and then this thing of being even the janitor comes up, and actually you gotta be, I don't know, you gotta deal with uncertainty, you gotta deal with everything that is difficult about creating something from scratch, but it is rewarding. That's what I can say. It's hard. It's very, very hard, but it pays.
The two things that stood out to me, and I can relate, you know, having my own company, is first a sense of purpose, right? Like being an employee, you can certainly find that sense of purpose. But for me, I wanted to be a part of something that I really believed in. And, you know, health and fitness, you know me, has been a big part of my life. And then spreading the word of growth mindset is my new journey with this podcast.
That's amazing.
The other thing is like fulfillment. And you said something that I thought was really good, which was you as a business owner, this is your blank canvas, and it allows you to kind of paint it with the colors that you find most beautiful. And that is fulfillment in a nutshell, right? Is doing the things that you want to do, feeling like you have a sense of purpose, but doing it your way. I can't tell you how much I hate having somebody tell me what to do. You know what I mean? And there's no amount of money out there that would ever give me a sense of fulfillment and purpose if I just listened to somebody else tell me how to do my job personally. Maybe that's just my arrogance, but
it could be.
It could be. That's okay.
It is true. I think something very hard about having your own company, it is also that, I feel like I don't have a boss, but I have, I don't know, right now I have almost 70 bosses who are my customers, and that can be even more bossy and hard than any boss that I had in my life. And you can't quit. you can't say, you know what, I don't take this anymore, just go away, I quit. There are some customers that you can let go, and for sure you have to let them go. But it's pretty hard. And even if you are the boss, there are so many responsibilities, and you have a team that depends on you. So they are not telling you what to do, but for sure they are expecting you that you succeed in anything that you're doing, because their salaries depend on you, probably their families depend on you. So there are a lot of, I don't know, expectations that you gotta fulfill. And that's for me, I have discovered that over time, it is even harder than having a boss telling you what to do every day. But on the other side, you have the freedom to actually discover the best way to reach your purpose and do whatever you feel it is right, and go for it. You have this freedom, but you have on the other side way more obligations. As an employee, as I said, you have to do your job, and you gotta be really good at your job, and that's it. Because you know there is a structure built around you, so that you can focus on the only thing that you can do. You have to be good. Building a company, you have to think of a lot of things, and you have to, I don't know, fulfill a lot of expectations and obligations, which is makes it harder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think having employees that are relying on you for a paycheck, I can't imagine like how stressful that is, because they, you know, obviously customers are important. They're the lifeblood of the company, but just the level of stress that you must deal with to make sure that your employees get paid every week, every month has got to be tremendous. How do you deal with that stress?
Well, I have built some, I don't know, like strategies or tools for myself. Schedules also. When we began, I didn't have any schedules. Actually, I was working the whole time. Now I am trying to mitigate that. So that, for example, from 8 p.m., usually I disconnect. I try not to think about work, about the company, because it can actually consume you, your head, your time. Once I arrive home, I try to leave behind the company and my job. The weekends, I try to respect them. So I don't work on the weekends. Of course, there's always something that comes up. So it's difficult, but I try to respect that. And now I am going to the gym. I don't see any results actually, but I feel good. That's important. But yeah, actually, you should train me a little bit. I think I am not doing a good job. For that matter, but I'm trying to go to the gym.
I will write you out a program. I promise you. That is hilarious.
Please. Please. But yeah, no, actually doing some sport, it is very important. It keeps me, I don't know, it takes the stress away. And I'm trying to biking a little bit more. I don't know, taking time for me. And actually, you know, Being the CEO and the leader of this company is actually understanding that my role is to actually think for the organization and making important decisions, having the vision, communicating the vision, and not being present in every single task, in every small task, in the day-to-day, because fortunately, we have a team and we have leaders and we have a C-level. So that's something that I've been working on as a leader, and taking more time for me and disconnecting from the company, because you can be very easily consumed by the business.
No, absolutely. Well, you said it earlier, right? Like, this company is your baby. And so to relinquish a task to somebody else has got to be difficult, because you want to oversee it, make sure they're doing it the right way, make sure they're doing it the way that you have visioned it to be executed. Like, that's got to be really challenging to just, yeah, okay, now you do it while I go do this. But when you're able to do that, that's got to just free up your mental capacity, not just your time, but your mental capacity as well, so you can focus on other parts of the business.
I think it is part of the journey as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
To actually, because it feels like a baby, but at a given moment, you need to understand that for it to grow bigger, it needs to be independent of you. The less important you are for the organization, the more resilient and bigger it can get. But it is actually a matter of finding people you trust and finding people that you are actually comfortable of delegating and saying, you take care of that, you're in charge, you make the decisions. I don't matter for I don't know, for that thing you are dealing with. Yeah, that's something you need to do to be a good leader. Just the less important you are, I think, the better.
Love that. That's great, man. Have you noticed anything about yourself that's changed? Like, have you become a different person in any ways?
Yeah, I think I am bolder now. I don't know if you if you can tell.
Oh, you're still a handsome stuff, man. I can't tell.
Thank you very much. Now, a lot of things. Of course, you need to grow in terms of confidence, in terms of I don't know, being more strategic, more resilient, also because each day you need to keep focused on what matters. You need to keep solving problem solving solution set of mind. And actually, something that I have learned, I think, something about being a good salesman, which for you, it's quite easy. For me, it was a completely new stuff. Some set of skills about selling the company, selling the product, selling our vision, that I have learned. I'm still learning, but I need to keep learning. I think we are learning, and I am learning all the time. A lot of things. I would say mostly a bunch of soft skills related to being a leader, being a salesman, having the, I don't know how to say that, like the good instinct to find the best talent and to connect with people that can help you out, reaching out to the best possible investor, reaching out to the best possible accelerator. Once you begin to connect with a lot of people, a lot of opportunities come up, a lot of doors open, and you need to have like the instinct. I would say there is some kind of wisdom. It is actually that a teacher of mine in the university told me that the best decisions were made with the solar plexus. You don't take them with the head, neither with the guts, because with the head you are very rational, so you don't take risks. But with the guts, you do no matter what. It's way too passionate. So the wisdom through wisdom is in the solar plexus, and that's something that I think you begin to develop once you are conscious about that and you begin to use it. And that is something that I think it gets more sharp. There are some decisions that I have made that were not very rational, but felt right here in the solar plexus, and they were the good decisions. So I think that's, I don't know, that's a skill quite difficult to explain, but I think it is very, very important.
I can attest to that. I think that I've made every mistake in the book. And I think just falling on your face and learning from it is the best teacher, unfortunately. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
As you mentioned something about like asking a question and like thinking about your solar plexus, trying to get that gut feeling. I was listening to a podcast the other day. I can't remember what it was, but they said if you want to get down to the best possible answer, ask yourself the same question three different times. The first time you're going to put your hands on your head, so you're going to think about it very logically, very rationally. The second one is you want to ask the same question, but you know, hold your heart. So you get, what is my intention? What am I really trying to get at? And then the third one is to hold your stomach and try to ask that same question to get more of that gut response, right? And really like, is my instinct right here? And ask that question three times. I thought that was pretty good. A little bit woo-woo in a lot of ways, but nevertheless, I kind of liked it.
Yeah, for sure. It looks like very flu. I don't know. It's not quite clear how it works, but I am sure it works. It works. There is like an instinct that you develop, not only for doing business, but for everything in life, but in business, I think it is very, very, very important. Connecting with people, just knowing that it can work out with him, but maybe not with him, and not from a place of prejudice or anything, just some kind of connection that you feel and you say, we're going that way.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think kind of going back to your point earlier about having to learn how to be a salesman, if I could give any advice to anybody out there, the best way to sell is to be authentic and genuine. and really care about the person and care about the problems that you're solving. You don't have to have like this outgoing, gregarious personality where you connect and you woo them and schmooze them and it's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors. It's about listening, understanding what problems and frustrations they have, and then genuinely trying to offer a solution to it. That's the most important way to be a salesman, in my opinion and in my experience.
No, I think it is, and that's something that I have learned. I think sometimes we have like this perspective or prejudice that a good salesman, it's like that, you know, it's very chatty and it's gonna convince you. And no, the best way is just to listen and connect with the pain, with the problem the customer has, and then actually, and from a meaningful position, trying to offer a solution, a real solution, but actually listening. And I have discovered that as I am a good listener, I can be a good salesman. But that's something new. That's something I have learned in these couple of years of developing my company and having to sell something totally quite new and completely different and anything. But once you are capable of listening, it becomes quite easier.
Yeah. Do you do anything to practice those skills, or are you just kind of learning by being in the field and just giving it practice and repetition?
I think it is a lot of practice and repetition. And as you said, just going out and falling and, you know, and iterating and learning and doing it again and doing it again. I think that's the most important thing. But in this path, I've had a lot of good mentors. Right now, we are a part of Endeavor, which is an accelerator in which we have access to a lot of mentors and coaches, and they are helping us a lot. We went through another accelerator, very well known here in Latin America and in Colombia. It's Torre Negra Accelerator. The owner is one of the sharks in Shark Tank Colombia. He and his team actually were very, very, very helpful for us in terms of teaching us a set of marketing skills, sales skills, a lot of things that we needed, and having a broader vision of our business, the market. So I think it is a combination of actually learning from people who knows this type of things and going out and doing them.
Right.
If you don't do them, you will never learn. But yeah,
totally. I think the most important step of any entrepreneurial's journey is just taking one step after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other, and being consistent with it. I can't tell you how many things I've had to learn along the way. I don't think anything that I was doing in my previous job translates to what I'm doing today. So everything is brand new, right? And it's just a matter of going out there and applying that skill set, learning from it, and you know, hoping for the best, I suppose. I want to wrap up. You again did a perfect job of laying up this next segue. I want to have fun with this next set of questions here, because I am incredibly curious about this. So you alluded to being on Shark Tank Colombia. I have to say that is the coolest thing ever, man. I watch Shark Tank. My parents watch Shark Tank. My sister watches Shark Tank. My brother watches Shark Tank. So as far as I'm concerned, you're a celebrity. What was that experience like? How did you even get on the show? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. It was amazing. We were not aiming for that. We got a call from, they have a team who is doing like searching for interesting companies in different fields. And actually they were looking for some company in the legal tech field, because there are not a lot of companies from the legal field going to Shark Tank. And since in the last years, there has been, I don't know, interesting things happening in the legal tech sector. So I think they reached out to some companies. We were selected for just for an invitation to participate. We had to go through a long process of filters and selection and interviews. And finally, I don't know, after 3 months or something like that, we got a call and they were telling us that we were selected and that we will be on air recording next week, something like that.
Okay.
No, I'm lying. They told us we were selected and that we were going to receive a call letting us know when we're going to go to record the episode. Then I think we had a month, and then we got a call. You are on television next week.
Yeah. Okay.
So we had like a month to prepare a little bit what was going to happen over there.
So hold on, let me back up real quick. So you were not trying to be on Shark Tank. They reached out to you spontaneously. That's really interesting. Okay. And then when you're preparing for this process, do they give you like a format that you have to follow? Like, okay, we're going to give you 30 seconds to pitch, and then we're going to ask you questions, like to give you like instructions on how to prepare for it? Or you just kind of go in there cold turkey, like, I hope this goes well. We'll do our best.
I don't know. I don't know. I have an NDA, so I'm not sure that I...
Okay.
There are some things that I can't tell.
Okay.
I'm not sure which things I cannot tell. I'm going to tell
you. That's fair. I'm actually not surprised that they had you sign an NDA.
No, they give you the format. So what we knew is that we had 7 minutes to do the pitch. And after the 7 minutes, we were going to have questions from the sharks. There is not like a time schedule closed. What they told us is it can go from 20 minutes or, I don't know, 2 hours. It depends on the interest they have. It depends on the questions that, I don't know, they come up. And we had two meetings before actually going there to the show, giving us some perspective about how it goes, some rules that we have to follow in terms of exposition. You cannot wear brands different from your own brand for these reasons. You know, you can go there with, I don't know, with Nike shoes, that right. kind of things, you know, that kind of rules.
Interesting.
No, and that's it. We didn't have a clue on the date, the exact date. We didn't know the spot neither. So as how it works is that they send a cab for you that picks you up. It's just something like if you were going to get kidnapped or something like that.
No way.
You have no idea. Yeah, you have no idea. So they send a cab. The cab picks you up, takes you to the place. And there, we were a set of startups that were selected.
Right.
We were waiting for going on air. And that's pretty much like the process of actually getting there.
So if I hear you correctly, you get an anonymous call from some random person who wants you to be on Shark Tank. Then they tell you that you can't wear any specific type of clothing except for your own. And then they put bags over your head and then they pick you up in a taxi cab and they take you to an undisclosed location. And you're just praying that these people are legit. Okay.
No, I love that without the bags over our heads.
But... Okay, I love that. No, that's hilarious. Yeah. It actually makes sense that they would do it like that, but I'm obviously being, you know, facetious here. So if I obviously watched it probably 8, 9, 10 times trying to figure out what was being said because it's all in Spanish. I didn't even try looking for like it translated and it doesn't exist out there, but in either case, from what I understand, you were proposing 10% of the company for $100,000. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if they reached out to you anonymously, like, how did you come up with that number? Like, were you looking for an investor? Were you like, oh, what a godsend. This is good for us. Or were you like, I don't know, let's just go with 10% for 100K. That makes sense.
And now, as I told you, the process of actually getting selected, I think it was about 3 months. So they evaluate a lot of things about the company. They evaluate the growth, the traction, your market, unit economics. So they already know very well the company before being selected. The proposal and the negotiation goes live, and there is a difference between the team that is actually recruiting the companies and the mm-hmm. sharks.
Right.
They wanna keep like this, I don't know, novelty factor about you being in front of them. They are actually discovering the company on live. They don't have a clue about Recu or the unit economics or the traction or the market, anything. So there is the team behind the show that knows everything about the company, but the sharks don't have a clue. So they discover it through the questions they are asking and the valuation that we are exposing and the justification and if we connect and everything that goes live and it is true and it is real. The negotiation happens there. We were raising funds at the moment. So we already had the valuation. We already had, I don't know, we were kind of prepared for that kind of scenario. I was already pitching the company with angel investors and everything. But no, we were not aiming for Shark Tank, but we were already prepared for that kind of scenario.
Right.
In any case, Shark Tank is not similar to anything else.
Totally.
It is a reality show. First thing, it is a TV program. So the dynamic, the interactions are not the usual interactions you have with a VC or with any other investor. And also, I don't know, the scenario, the set, it's very unique for me. It was my first time in television for sure. So actually having, I don't know, 50 cameras on you and, you know, and people telling you, you gotta stand there. The mark is there. The light arrives that way. The music, that's something that it's not similar to anything else. Any pitch that we had before, it's completely different for that.
Oh, no, I can't imagine. Like, just the environment alone had to have been incredibly intimidating, a lot of pressure. You probably practiced and practiced and practiced, but in that moment, how do you prepare for that? You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like an impossible thing. But the nice thing about Shark Tank is, and I want to get to your deal in a minute, but it's great publicity. I mean, you're showcasing your company, you're showcasing you, your personality, the whole nine. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a win-win for Recu or any company out there that's, you know, trying to get exposure. So that's gotta be exciting, yeah, sure. Man. You know?
For sure. I had a friend before actually applying for the show. I talked to a friend of mine that had already been through Shark Tank. He was already there, and actually for me it didn't go well for his company. So I asked him, is it worth it? Do you think it is a good thing? And he told me, yeah, for sure, just for the publicity and exposure. At the moment he had some very harsh critics on his business model and everything, mm-hmm. but then he found the way to actually reversing those critics and doing genius marketing around that. And it worked really well. So what he told me is, there is not such thing as bad publicity if you're smart enough. So go ahead and participate. If you get selected, it will help you out. And for us, it has been very helpful in terms, of visibility. But the most important thing, truly, it's been having Alexander Torrenegra and his accelerator behind us. We learned a lot with them, and it helped us to actually accelerate. Free publicity for Torrenegra accelerator, but not for sure. Amazing.
I did a little bit of research on Alexander because him and his wife live in Miami or somewhere in Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
In Napa Valley.
Oh, they're in California, in Napa Valley. Okay. For some reason, I thought it was in Florida, but in either case, really interesting guy. So it sounds like he's been really helpful. That's another kind of question. Like, how involved is he, or is he more or less again, going back to the relationship type of thing, he kind of helps with the connections. Obviously, he's been in business for a number of years. He's very successful. He's done a very good job. He can probably make connections very easily. How involved is he with Reku?
Yeah, well, actually, his team has helped us a lot.
Yeah.
As I told you, we began to be one of the companies of the Torrenegra Accelerator. He has an accelerator in which we were included. And as a part of this acceleration program, we've had access to mentors, to investors, to coaching, a lot of accountability that you need as an entrepreneur. And a mindset of bootstrapping and actually accelerating the business model, the product development. One thing that I usually tell about the program, it's that first meetings we had and with the product development team, we were telling them that, we had a development goal set for 1 month, and the answer was it is not enough. It doesn't work for us. 1 month is too long. Okay, so maybe 3 weeks, not enough. Should be shorter. Okay, 1 week, now it doesn't work. And it should be for tomorrow. And there we were like, that's sick. We cannot accomplish that for tomorrow. But the logic was, don't make me promises about 1 month. Think about what you can accomplish tomorrow. In order to actually get to that monthly goal. Gotcha. So in order to go faster, you need to have shorter delays for everything, for product development, for marketing, for sales. And it actually makes sense, because when you have a company that has 3 years of existence or 2 years of existence, 1 month is the 5% of the lifetime of your company. So it is long. You cannot think all the time in terms of months. You need to set for daily goals. And it actually completely changed the mindset of the team. So, and that's something that we're doing. We're setting daily goals, which doesn't mean that you are working more. It's just that you're more aware and you have more accountability of what should be happening every day. In all the, in all the teams.
Yeah. I can relate to that. I mean, my company's nowhere near yours, but I found that when I was making monthly goals, I wasn't focusing on revenue generating activities, right? Which is really important for every company, is those little bite-sized, consistent activities that are going to generate notoriety, generate revenue, If I was thinking about it from a month out, I was thinking about these big, long projects that was eaten up all day long. And I wasn't making any legitimate strides. So I had to scale back, look at my day-to-day, look at my schedule. Okay, what is the most important thing I can do right now to propel my company forward? If I'm looking at it from a larger perspective, look, I've got the most grandioso ideas for this company, and they're fun and they're exciting. And it's a fun little mindset to live in, but it doesn't move the needle by any means. You know what I mean? So I really like that. Well, good, man. I'm really happy for you. What was the ultimate deal that you guys reached? Did you guys get the $100,000 for 10%?
For 10%, but not of the company, not equity,
okay,
but a participation in the revenue. So it's a revenue sharing scheme in which he has a percentage of the actual revenue during a period of time until the ROI makes sense in terms of investment.
Do you ever watch the Shark Tank US?
Yeah, for sure. It's amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like Kevin O'Leary and like his strategy. He's always trying to get like royalties and companies, and he's like, I don't want equity, all royalty, you know.
Evergreen and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was, for me, it was a great thing because I have watched the show since forever, you know, here, the Shark Tank Colombia, but Shark Tank Mexico as well, that I love it, and the US for sure. So it was pretty sick to actually be there, to be in the elevator,
yeah,
and everything, and the music. I was kind of a fan living, I don't know if a dream, but it was quite fun for sure.
That's awesome, man. Well, congratulations. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I just want to say I'm incredibly proud of you, Jorge. You were a really good friend of mine in the MBA program, and to see you so successful and ambitious, I can't tell you how motivating it is for me to want to emulate that same ambition. So congratulations to you, brother. I'm super proud of you. Proud to call you a friend, and I'm excited to see how far you take this company, my man.
The same here. You know, I love you. I admire you. Congratulations for this new endeavor, for the podcast, which I love. You have the best fan here that I am going to listen to every single episode. Keep going, and I am still waiting for you here in Colombia. You gotta come.
I'm gonna come, man. I know. I've been talking about it for years, and I need to make it happen. Is there anything that you, how can people find you? How can people look up Recu if they're interested in learning a little bit more?
Yeah, no, Recu in Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn. I don't know for English speakers if it is going to be easy, but it's Recu Cartera. But it's not just Recu. Usually we are the first thing that pops up. So
cool. I'm going to, I'll put all the links in the description below. So if anybody's curious about it, check it out. I love the color scheme that you guys chose. So you need to get me a sweater. I'll wear that second all the time.
Yeah,
so.
For sure.
Cool.
Sure. I'll send one to your house.
I love it. Awesome. All right, Jorge, thank you so much, my man. Appreciate
your
time,
Quentin.
Brother.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir.